Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast in which we read, review, then discuss, in a whole spoilery way, but don't worry, we take a break first, an audiobook of a science fiction or fantastical nature. What are we reading this week?
The Atrocity Archives, a Laundry Files novel by Charles Stross.
Good old Charlie Stross. Who narrated it?
Well, depending on how he pronounces his name, it's either Gideon or Gideon Emery.
Okay.
I don't know which.
Great. I hope he does. Do we have a reading from the back of the book?
We do. Bob Howard is a low-level techie working for a super-secret government agency. While his colleagues are out saving the world, Bob's under a desk restoring lost data. His world was dull and safe, but then he went and got noticed. Now, Bob is up to his neck in spycraft, parallel universes, dimension-hopping terrorists, monstrous elder gods, and the end of the world. Only one thing is certain. It will take more than a full system reboot to sort this mess out.
Awesome. Kevin, what did you think?
I enjoyed it.
Great. Well, this has been Sci-Fi. No, I'm just kidding.
Yes. Well, mine is the only important opinion.
Yes. And it's also the shortest.
Yes. If I wanted your opinion, I would have given it to you.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. The one upside and equivalent downside is that it's very dated in like the early 2000s,
right,
late 1990s, and with like tech, you know, so everything's like Beowulf clusters and dial-up modems and stuff, which is kind of like, oh yeah, I forgot about some of that stuff. Like Beowulf clusters was like every other word on Slashdot back then. Like,
and so was Slashdot.
Yeah. Slashdot's still a thing?
I think it's still up.
I think it is.
I guarantee you it's still up. It's just not a thing anymore.
We'll have to ask Cowboy Neil. Anyway, yeah, this is actually one of my favorite books. It's and so I look forward to Barry's opinion because I just saw him kind of flinch. Yes, it's very dated. It's written in a very particular language. It's kind of a language that my brain kind of speaks natively in a way.
Yes.
It's, you know, very, very heavy tech jargon geek from the late 90s, early 2000s, vague era. The biggest problem that I have with it is I'm not British, and there's a lot of very specific British slang. And there's actually some kind of required knowledge to get some of the jokes in terms of, like, the first time I read through Concrete Jungle. So there's a sort of a novella that comes along with this called The Concrete Jungle. And he's talking all the time about concrete cows in. So, yes, the first time I read through it, I had never heard of The Concrete Cows of Milton Keynes, which is this very landmark piece of artwork. And it's referred to a bunch of times. And he never sits down and says, well, of course, the concrete cows are this. Rather, like, we wouldn't say, oh, well, the Golden Gate Bridge spans the entrance to San Francisco Bay.
Right. Yeah, it's, well, part of this, I think, is it's a definite parody on bureaucracy.
Sure.
And especially government bureaucracy. So if you've ever had that kind of a job, you know, that's some big bonus points as far as you getting what's going on and finding it amusing.
Right. Because this isn't a Lovecraft universe, but Bob faces down, the worst thing that Bob faces down is actually matrix management.
Yeah. I enjoyed this book quite a bit. I particularly like the setting. I'm not sure I care for all the writing. Like you said, there's a lot of, you know, Britishisms.
Right.
Oi, governor, give me the jammy Dodgers now.
Wow. That's the best British accent that I've heard since Dick Van Dyke or the last time I tried to do one.
You're welcome. This book reminded me an awful lot of, like, if Scott Adams, before he went like super crazy, would write for, like, say, Hellboy or something.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Charlie Stross is one of us. I mean, I think he used to program in Perl. He used to write for the Computer Shopper, at least that much I know. And there are references to a company that we all used to work at in the very first paragraph.
Well, that was another thing that I particularly enjoyed because we're from the Bay Area. So he talks about things in Santa Cruz and Davenport and other things. And it's like, oh, yes, yeah. I used to live at those or you know, been to those places. And,
right. So if you're us, I highly recommend this book.
If you're not us,
why are you listening to this podcast?
Give it a shot. See what happens.
Yes. All right. Well, is there anything further we should discuss?
Well, the most important thing that I didn't get until just a few minutes ago is that Bob Howard must be a reference to Robert E. Howard.
Partially. Also, it's not actually mentioned in here, but it's stated elsewhere that his middle initials are Oliver Francis, making his full initials B-O-F-H, the bastard operator from hell.
Okay.
Wow.
Also, I will have to give it props for being perhaps the only fiction novel in existence that within the first 5 minutes mentions symbolic lisp machines.
This has been an award you've been waiting to give out for quite some time. He's got the trophy and finally. Everything.
Well, yes. I do know someone that has some other boards in his office of symbolic lisp machines that works at NASA just down the street. So
this may also be the first book review podcast that has mentioned symbolic lisp machines.
Yes. Well, the bizarre thing about lisp machines is that they were basically like the first workstations. And
that is bizarre.
Well, it makes sense in the context of government bureaucracies that they are, their business model at the time was like, oh yes, each desktop costs $100,000 plus or whatever it is. And like, they're the size of refrigerators back then.
And no one would ever need more than $640,000.
I don't know how much the amount of memory was, but apparently they were pretty impressive at the time for how fast they could run Lisp. And the entire OS was written in Lisp, and it was, you can just, if there was a problem, you just pull up the, all of the software was right there on the drive. You just, fix the kernel and recompile it, and you don't even have to reboot, apparently. It just loads in the new kernel as the new threads change.
Isn't this that crazy operating system that guy wrote that you could basically,
Church
modify?
OS.
Yeah, modify on the fly.
This has been OS Talk, a book review podcast.
I really don't know what you're talking about.
I'm sure. Okay, well, I'm seeing some smoke coming out of the Beowulf cluster, and I need to go and hit it with something before Kevin tries to replace it with an Apple II.
It would be better.
Of course.
I'm just going to use the Hand of Glory and disappear.
That's a good idea. We shall return, for we are sci-fi.
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 And now we're back, because we weren't back before. That's great. I'm glad that I said that. And I'm leaving it in. Hell. Okay, so this is a book that, of course, yes, wallows in its Britishisms. This is I don't think that I really grasped until I heard it in audiobook form how really very British this is. Or, even English. Focus in past British. So we'll get one question out of the way early. Was there tea? Yes. And the first mention of actual tea was, I believe somebody gets hit over the head with a teapot.
Is that actual tea?
Well, no, teapots are not in fact made of tea.
Oh, they could be, but probably not.
Did it just produce like human tea or something?
I don't remember. But yes, there was at least a teapot, so I'm calling it a tea reference no matter what.
But there definitely were scenes where people were actually drinking tea. So.
Right. Some of the biggest issues that I had just understanding it wasn't really a problem that I had with the book, but sort of following what was going on was all in Milton Keynes, because I had no idea at the time that Milton Keynes was this sort of super planned community. And so it was, it's a little bit like sort of the...
It's a small city-sized university.
Yeah, basically. Yeah,
I had to look it up myself.
And there's the concrete cows. And then also it's a plot point that I don't think is really discussed absolutely anywhere, but it's actually at the time was well known for having a lot of CCTV cameras.
Isn't that most of...
Yeah, but that was
England?
Sort of like one of the earlier test cases, is my understanding.
Okay.
Well, that makes more sense as to why they were freaking out, because it was like, well, there's lots of them here, and mm-hmm. there's lots of them like by a bunch of financial buildings or something.
Right. And so
it's like everywhere, but
right. So somebody had basically come up with a Gorgon emulator a way of emulating something that looks at you and you turn to stone, and then so you just fix the CCTV camera so that its firmware is the important part of looking at you that turns you to stone.
Right, but we'd never actually export the firmware, so it has to be on an FPGA that's built into the camera such that, the requirements for making the cameras...
Well, I did actually love the fact of how they said, oh, we're just going to piggyback on the DMCA stuff that, the U.S. is going to shove down everyone's throats for copyright protection. Where,
as usual, we are the best and worst people to review this. We are the best to understand it in some ways, and we are the worst to actually explain it to people.
So yes, they're like, well, you know, that will get, you know, everybody will have this stuff, you know, supposedly for copyright protection purposes, but we'll just reflash the firmware so that it's Gorgon enabled, and we could, you know, it's like Medusa everybody and turn them to stone. And actually, that was a good example of something I did like in the book where, you know, I can't say, oh, it's scientifically accurate, but, you know, given this, you know, thing of it would work, then he gives some quasi-scientific explanation of, and then spontaneously some of the carbon atoms turn into silicon atoms and, like, you know, gain some protons or neutrons or whatever it was. And then, right, you know, and then he's like, and that cascades this and makes it incredibly, you know, incredibly unstable. And, like, it pulls electrons. And then, of course, it heats up and it looks kind of like a glowing, you know, stove, yeah, you know, and then they blow, their ash blows away. And so it's like, hey, you're like, hey, that is how I would imagine that happening in, you know, in movies or whatever.
Exactly. I don't think that I understood exactly what was going on here until we went on our sort of Lovecraft binge. But this is the Lovecraft universe.
Yeah.
He never quite explicitly says, oh, I'm in the Lovecraft universe, because, you know, we rarely say which universe we're in.
Right.
I mean, it's
the worst one possible.
In prime universe.
It's some kind of test facility to see what humans will take. But
the Kevin Prime universe. Yes.
Kevin Prime universe. Or we're all in that stupid snow globe.
Damn it, stop shaking it.
But
look at the size of that snowflake.
Indeed. I mean, there is reference to Lovecraft as a fiction writer, or at least as a writer. But in this universe, all of the sort of incantations and stuff that Lovecraft references and all of the previous weird fiction authors reference, they actually work. But since it's Charlie Strauss writing it, they work through computational theory.
Right. Yeah. They do mention, you know, references to things like Under the Ocean or, you know, some other Lovecraft monsters. But that it did remind me of there's this, you know, Harold Shea and the Enchanter books by DeCamp and Pratt. And that was another one where they essentially use math or some form of logic to, you know, transport themselves to fantasy worlds. And so it's another, you know, in this lineage of, like, you know, high math, you know, makes magic kind of.
Right, exactly. So it's a high logic world. And Charlie Strauss, again, being Charlie Strauss, yeah, he figured out, oh, wait a minute, if you could write a computer program to do this, then it would be much more powerful than, say, somebody chanting on top of a hill someplace.
So I was actually thinking that this was a pretty pure homage to Lovecraft. Because, mm-hmm, you know, when Lovecraft wrote his stuff, right, you know, the science that he was including in there, which we kind of look back and go, oh, that's kind of hokey, right? And, you know, everyday science at this point, or, well, maybe not putting brains in bottles, but was pretty fantastic to
leave
to
my hobbies out of this. Yes. Don't mind.
But, you know, this is sort of just like the next evolution, right?
Mm-hmm.
So right. I thought that was,
yeah, kind exactly of neat,
you know, thinking about it. You know, after the first listen, I had to go back and listen to it again.
Mm-hmm.
So
I did really like how he talked about, you know, oh, there's things hidden down deep at the bottom of fractals and stuff like that, where it's kind of like, as a computer programmer, you want to believe that you could somehow really do some magical thing by writing some bizarre, you know, yeah, program.
But there are, of course, consequences. Like, for example, he's brought into the organization when he thought he discovered a neat new kind of fractal, but instead he'd nearly, what, re-landscaped the town he was in.
Right. He basically almost like set off some giant, you know, energy release of some kind.
Right. And it's never quite explained exactly what he was doing, but, you know, they refer to it on occasion. The other interesting thing is, this is a sort of secret history where Alan Turing was murdered because he wrote a different theorem that basically said, oh, magic is real and we can control it and we can do all of this stuff.
Right. And in a way, I don't want to look too deeply in it, because it's really easy to, like, you know, as we found out, you start looking into, like, what a secret history, you know, parallel universe description of something would be. And it seems like there's lots of evidence.
So it's like, you know, it's like when your crazy grandpa, you know, starts watching a lot of Fox News.
Basically.
I mean, yeah, Alan Turing, quote unquote, committed suicide, wink, with an apple. Forward reference there. That's actually secretly what Apple Computer is named after.
It's the disembodied soul of Alan Turing.
It's the disembodied soul of Alan Turing. He put poison on an apple and then ate it.
Oh.
Yes.
Is that actually in this book?
No, in reality.
Oh, okay.
In this book, he was murdered and it was made to look like suicide.
Okay.
And so then they talked about other stuff like, you know, Hilbert, you know, there were some other things that he had done that were like, you know, further math proofs that go into, you know, Lovecraftian kind of summonings and things like that. And I thought it was interesting how, you know, another sort of back reference is, you know, he always has his Palm Pilot, you know, sort of the first, you know, really commercial
PDA. Hard for me to remember. Yeah, he upgrades to an iPhone later on.
Oh, several years later.
Several years later, yes. He's still writing these books.
Yeah, and that, like I said, like, you know, I had a Palm Pilot and like I had kind of forgotten about it until I reread this and I'm like, oh, that's right. Those were like really, really popular.
I had one, yeah.
And he's always pulling out his, you know, in the story, he pulls out the Palm Pilot and it's like, oh yeah, you know, we have this thing, you know, hidden in the back that does some magical thing. And
right. The Palm Pilot is his sonic screwdriver, basically.
Basically, it has like that's how he, you know, towards the end, they're in that other dimension where all the Nazis, you know, were hiding out in the pocket universe or something, and like they, you know, he's like, oh, we need to sneak past these, like, you know, undead creatures or something that were possessed. And he's like, oh, I just need a hand of glory. You know, I could make them, you know, by, you know, downloading this neural network, you know, that I keep, you know, a copy of on my Palm Pilot into the, you know.
I thought the hand of glory was a physical object that he had.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a hand of glory is sort of this ritual object that it's supposed to be made of the hand of a wrongly executed man, and you can use it to go invisible. But he's actually sort of repurposed it as a weapon because he figures that, you know, it's some sort of entropy conversion system that allows you to sort of, it's kind of a perception filter, you right. know, light kind of bends around you.
But when he made them, he basically, you know, said, oh, here, I can make them because I have the neural network, you know, in a source file on my Palm Pilot.
Because, you know, I use the theorem where, you know, everything is that was NP is now P.
Right. Yes, basically. And yeah, they did
yet another
that.
Us joke.
Yeah. Yeah. If the phrase, oh, it was NP complete is a laugh line for you, you will love this book.
It's hilarious. But yeah, I thought, you know, I did enjoy the stuff where he would spit out a bunch of, you know, semi, you know, the little bits were accurate by themselves.
Right.
Like he talked about there's, you know, where he's trying to figure out what's actually going on. And it's like too easy of a solution. He's like, okay, we, you know, we were drawn into this side universe, you know, his quasi girlfriend gets kidnapped in this old Nazi plot. And they're like, what's going on?
The fact they had drawn a picture of Hitler into the side of the planet in 10 kilometer deep trenches was kind of amusing.
Yeah. You're sort of like, okay, they're really, you know, the hardcore, you know, Nazi SS group that was doing this.
I mean, definitely reminded me of that episode of The Tick where I think one of the villains there attempts to carve his own image into the side of the moon using a laser.
That does sound like something from that show.
Yes. Oh, and a little bit of a backstory that was in the afterword of the print edition, but I don't think it made it into this, was in the first part of the book, he's going after Iraqi intelligence type of guys. In the first draft, it was the Taliban. And then after September 11th and the military response, he sort of thought, oh, the Taliban are all going to be wiped out. I'm going to rewrite this to be the Iraqis. But of course, the Taliban still exist. And so he may have done better to
just left it as it
left
was.
Left it as it was.
Or just made something up.
The Suleiman. No, that was in Star Trek. And that was also based on the Taliban.
Oh, God. It never occurred to me.
And then we defeated them with tachyons.
Well, the, you know,
tetrions.
As we found out, the Nazis are a perpetually good bad guy because
I hate those guys.
Yes, because Nazis and, you know, it's so, you know, that, you know, being formulaic, but it still works.
Right.
Especially with, you know, the, you know, Hitler really saying, hey, you know, all this crazy, you know, magic stuff, maybe it'll really work. And
sure.
So, you know, another kind of secret history thing built into it without trying very hard. But some of the stuff I did like were things like where he says, oh, we're, he's trying to figure out what's going on. He's like, it's really cold and there's all this, you know, our radio transmissions aren't working. And so the stuff that's like quasi techno babble where he's like, oh, the Planck constant is changing and stuff like that. But, you know, he does say stuff that actually would happen when the universe is kind of growing dim, where he's like, you know, the black holes have evaporated.
Right.
And, you know, the universe is like shrunk down in size, this really small thing.
It's basically the Pandorica opens.
Yes, yes. So I did enjoy sort of those little bits of, you know, well, at least that part is true. You string them together, it kind of sounds plausible.
Well, the way I kind of think of this is, you know, when I read a fantasy novel and it makes enough sense, part of my brain kicks in. It's just like, okay, well, if this were true and this were true and this were true, then all of these stories could be true. And I think, you know, Charlie Strauss, having read through all of these things, decided to write a novel where, well, what if Lovecraft were all scientifically valid?
Right.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, when I say, well, this fantasy novel would make perfect sense if they were all in a virtual reality, and you all look at me funny.
We are in a virtual reality.
I mean it is sort of the same methodology that's used like in a lot of Star Trek episodes, right? Where, mm-hmm. you know, you spout enough science to make it seem plausible and, you know, therefore your suspension of disbelief kicks in and then you can spend the time to enjoy the,
right.
you know, what you're watching. So.
Exactly. And in later books, he goes a little bit into more detail as to how spells are a programming language, and he becomes adept at actually like writing these in his head. And there are some consequences to that as well.
Damn, it's a recursive,
you know. Oh, and
stack heap collision.
So, full disclosure, I've met Charles Strauss very briefly and had a very awkward conversation. On my end, not his. I mean, you know, he was just dealing with another deranged fan, and I was just like, you write book.
Yeah, yes. Another one of those weird elevator conversations. Yeah. I've read books you do.
I mean, because all that's going through my head is, I have no reason to talk to you. I have no reason to talk to you. I'm interrupting you from writing. I don't like doing this.
At least he didn't get out his PDA and vaporize you.
Maybe this is all just in those few seconds. Maybe I'm trapped forever doing a review of his book.
That's not happening. Don't tell him.
Let's see. Also,
stay on the Ooplay. Yes.
There are a couple of characters named Pinky and the Brain in this. And I was telling my wife that it reminded me of a couple of friends of ours. And she said, well, you know, they do know Charles Strauss. Maybe it's them.
Pinky and the Brain know Charles Strauss?
They're putative real life originals. We'll leave it at that.
Interesting. At least some.
I'm kind of reverse name dropping somehow. I know people that might be related to other fictional people, and I'm not going to say who they are.
Good.
That's I have a good memo, but I'm not going to show you what's in it.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, so another thing that he has to face in this is matrix management, i.e., well, there's the person that tells you what to do, and then there's your boss and all of this crazy bureaucratical nonsense. The problem is that his on-paper boss keeps on yelling at him because his supposed day job is, you know, running Ethernet cables and,
right.
you know,
yeah, it's like tech support, monkey, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And so his boss isn't actually cleared to know all of, you know, the fact that he went to the moon and he's camping out in, you know, mysterious places and so forth.
Right.
And so
she's like, why didn't you do this time, you know, overtime sheet?
Right. Right. You know, you didn't fill out this and you didn't, you know, sign up for sick leave. We're going to, you know, need a doctor's note. And I'm sorry, Bob, I just don't know what to do with it. We can't cover for you anymore.
Right. And he's just like, you're not clear to know this stuff. I've been like, you know, tortured in a hell dimension for 5 days straight or whatever. Yeah, it was.
Exactly.
Like, you know. And
I mean, some ways it's the bureaucratic revenge fantasy of, well, right. It'd be great if you could appeal to your real boss who actually can literally shrink people's heads and keep them alive in a horrible hell for all eternity.
I'm just hoping that in one of the later books that, you know, somehow like his spell programming language is then subject to like Six Sigma development practices or something.
Something like that. There's a lot of talk about dangling pointers.
That's what ghosts are.
You're close.
Well, that's what I always thought in my head. That's what ghosts would be.
Again, you are the perfect and worst person to read this book.
God.
So the
So close to the kitchen, he knows so far from the knives.
That's your new motto, isn't it?
Is that on the t-shirt he's wearing?
In Enochian.
But mushrooms?
Yes, absolutely. Moving on.
But yeah, he's it is very Brazil-like, right? Where it's like the bureaucracy from hell, paperwork in triplicate, and his real boss is, you know, probably rightly convinced about monitoring. So he's like using an old mechanical typewriter.
Oh, no. He's using
He actually has a great desk.
Yeah, he's got the Memex now. Yeah. And this is my college paper on the Memex.
Did you really?
Yes. Well, among other things, it was a rather sprawling college paper. It was a hypertext.
Yeah, it was basically a predecessor to the World Wide Web.
Yes, exactly.
Almost like a mechanical World Wide Web.
It was basically, it was invented by a man named Vannevar Bush. It was it wasn't invented. It was described by him. They never actually built the thing. But the idea was, you would have everything would be sort of printed on these sheets, and then you could, there would be a mechanical way of creating a link between this sheet and the next. Right. And so, you know, it would probably make this horrible grinding noise as you clicked on a hyperlink.
This sounds like the most awesome Brazil-like thing ever.
Oh, yeah. It would have been fantastic. And it never quite got built for the similar reason of, you know, the Charles Babbage thing. It's just like, would have required a lot of technology that hadn't fully gelled yet.
They did do some. If you go to the Computer History Museum, they actually have kind of a subversion of that where there's like, you know, you could pull data out of like this microfilm repository, and I might be conflicting a couple things, but basically part of it is this huge system that takes film in real time, makes a print and develops it for you in like 30 seconds or something like that. And it sounds like, you know, the mechanical version of that.
Yeah. And so, the Memex, you know, he has to basically play it like a pipe organ. And that's how Angleton, Bob's boss, stores data, because you can't use Van Eyck freaking on it.
Right. And so,
of course, it's a term we all know. There's no reason for us to explain Van Eyck freaking.
I guess you could do it for other people if you want to.
The idea being, at least with CRTs, that you could essentially pick up on the signal coming out of the monitor and get it remotely.
Yeah, you basically read it through the walls using a van parked outside or something.
Right, so that wasn't the van in Van Eyck.
Yes, that was not my intent to drop that particular pun, but congratulations.
I will take it. The question is, does it get too jargony? And the answer is, depends on who you are.
I think it was, for me, it was a little, like, maybe like 5% too jargony.
On the edge. I mean, I did, the way that I finally understood it was, this is what it's like to really understand an Ada Palmer novel. I mean, like, I got through those by sort of clinging on the edge and going by my high school paper on the French history and so forth. I could mostly follow along. But if this was like your native language, then it's sort of like, you know, all of this is like, oh, wow, I know what he's talking about.
Right. Well, I mean, there's some overlap in style with like early Neal Stephenson stuff, but mid Neal Stephenson stuff, like Snow Crash.
Right.
Where there's kind of a discussion of how, you know, he drops into tech jargon as part of his explanation. So if you know what binary is, or you know why powers of two are, you know, seem like round numbers to someone who programs, then it's funny. Exactly. You know, it's like, haha, 32, haha, 64 also. You know, it's like, that was like a Snow Crash joke, which I thought was hilarious the first time I heard it. Like,
all right. Did we have any favorite scenes?
Probably the last one where they go to that dimension and it's like super cold and the alien's there. And
yes, that
they're
was
trying to trick them into nuking it to give it energy to come back and destroy the Earth.
Exactly.
Or the entire universe, I guess.
Yeah, I really like the opening sequence where he's sort of crawling into somebody's window and, you know, typing on something. And it's your classic, the spy goes in and looks at stuff on the computer, but it's described by somebody who actually knows what they're talking about.
I think my favorite scene was probably the one where they're sort of backtracking the sort of barbecued cow.
Yes.
I'm not sure why, but
barbecued cow.
All right. Was there anything else we wanted to talk about?
Well, Just the one last bit of trivia, like that scene at the end, after the end of credits, you got to wait for it. Like I mentioned, the Symbolic List Machine, symbolics.com is the first .com domain registered.
Okay. I'm glad that we got to that. Otherwise, we would not have.
Yes.
All right. Well, I believe that entropy is increasing, and I'm looking up and I'm seeing Kevin's face on the moon, which is really disturbing. So I believe somebody's
there,
got,
you know,
some kind of deal. So until next time, assuming that the heat death of the universe does not come.
Oh, please. Oh, please. Oh, please.
We have been sci-fi.
Sci-fi.
Sci-fi.